Welcome, everybody, to the Bereans Bible Institute. I'm Tim Warner, your teacher. We are in module number 11, the book of Revelation. This is lesson number 30. Today, we'll be covering Revelation 12, verses 6 through 17. Now, I want to make a correction, something I said in the previous lesson. It's really inconsequential, but I stated that Rosh Hashanah was on in the month Nisan, the Hebrew month Nisan. That's incorrect. That's Passover is in the Hebrew month Nisan. I should have said the month Tishri. I said that, I think, a couple of times in that lesson. I don't know what I was thinking, but anyway, just wanted to make that little bit of a correction there. Now, last time we talked about the identity of the woman in the first five verses of Revelation chapter 12. We don't need to repeat that, just that the woman is, first of all, she's seen as the constellation Virgo in the constellations, but also that it's a representation of the children of promise through Sarah. And so Sarah is technically the woman who gives birth to the child of promise, who was Isaac, which was the beginning of God fulfilling the covenant that he made with Abraham. And so in Galatians chapter 4, we see that the Apostle Paul refers to all of those who are baptized into Christ. Actually, that's in Galatians 3. All those baptized into Christ are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. In verse 16 of that chapter, he said that the seed in the promise was Christ. That is, Christ is the ultimate fulfillment of the promise of Abraham to Abraham and his seed. The reason that it includes us as well is because when we get down to the end of that chapter, it says those who have been baptized into Jesus Christ have put on Christ. Then he says there is neither male nor female, but we are all Abraham's seed. So it's by us, by this union of us to Christ, the Son of God, who came, who became human through the seed of Abraham, that is through Mary, that we are viewed by God as being one with his Son. And that concept is all through the book of Isaiah, but it's also throughout the Gospel of John, believe it or not. It uses terminology that indicates that God views all true believers as one person, that is his Son, God's Son. We are joined in our baptism to his Son. And so God looks at the inheritance that he's promised to his Son. It would include all of us because we have become part of, in God's sight, we have become part of his Son. All right, now, I mentioned last time that the first five verses of Revelation 12 are really all about identifying who the woman is. And it does so by giving a little bit of her history, right? And her history of as Sarah, all the descendants of Sarah, the children of promise, all the way down to Christ, who is the man-child. And then he's caught up into heaven, which is the fulfillment of Psalm 110, verse 1. And then the serpent who tried to destroy him, first through Herod and his persecution or killing of the infants, and then throughout Jesus' ministry, and then finally it talks about him being, Christ being caught up to God's throne. All right, now, beginning in verse 6, we have the future actual prophecy. All right, so 1 through 5 sets the stage. It tells us who the players are. And then verses 6 through 17 tell us how these players work out in this end time drama that's about to take place. All right, so let's read verses 6 through 17, and then we'll come back and comment on each, pretty much on each sentence, okay? All right, and the woman escaped into the wilderness, wherever she has a place there, having been prepared from God, so that they may be nourishing her there, 1,260 60 days. And there was war in the sky. Michael and his messengers fought the dragon, and the dragon fought and his messengers. And they did not prevail, nor was there any more room found for them in the sky. And the great dragon was thrown down, the original snake called the devil and Satan, the one deceiving the whole world. He was cast down to the ground, and his messengers were cast down with him. And I heard a great voice in the sky saying, "Finally, salvation and power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ has come, because the accuser of our brothers, the one accusing them before our God day and night, has been thrown down. And they were victorious over him through the blood of the Lamb and through the word of their witness. And they did not love their lives to the death. Through this rejoice, sky and those dwelling in it. Alas, to the inhabitants of the land and the sea, because the devil has come down to you having great anger, having known that he has a brief time. And when the dragon saw that he was thrown down to the ground, he pursued the woman who gave birth to the male child. And two wings of a great eagle were given to the woman that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished there a time, times, and half a time from before the snake. And the snake projected a current of water from his mouth after the woman, that he might sweep her away with the current. And the land rescued the woman, and the land opened its mouth and swallowed the current the dragon projected from its mouth. And the dragon was enraged against the woman and departed to battle with the remnants of her seed, of those who are keeping the commandments of God and holding the testimony about Jesus." All right, now let's get back to, go back to verse 6. It says, "And the woman escaped into the wilderness, wherever she has a place there." And notice the word "wherever" does not give us a location, right? It's an the term in the Greek is uncertain. That is, it's intended to be non-descriptive. It doesn't pinpoint a specific place. So there is a place, but it's not known at this time. The woman escaped into the wilderness, wherever she has a place there. Now, notice the clause, "having been prepared." Having been prepared. All right. Also, notice, having been prepared. The words "having been prepared" is a verb that's in the perfect tense. And so what that means is that it was prepared previously, but when she flees there, its preparation is complete. All right. So it says, she escaped into the wilderness. She has a place there, having been prepared from God. That is, God is the source of this place, having been prepared. So that they may be nourishing her there 1,260 days. Now, I want to point out, if you're using my translation, the Last Generation version, I have actually updated it on the website. And so if you have one, if you're using a printed copy in front of you, you might want to make a slight correction to that. All right, the words "so that they may be nourishing her there" ought to be in brackets, that is in parentheses, okay, because it's a parenthetical statement. I don't have parentheses around it in the earlier versions of this revelation. So if you have one of the earlier versions, you're not going to have those brackets there, but they need to be there because without them, you can easily misunderstand what he's talking about when he says 1,260 days, all right? Also, a correction should be made to the footnote. You see there's a footnote there. If you go down and read the footnote, hold on, I gotta put my glasses on, it's fine print. It says, "This number refers to the work of the two witnesses, the only other time it occurs." Revelation, I'm sorry, the footnote before that. The footnote attached to, 240. In this version of it, it says, the last part of it, it says that, After their initial period of prophesying for 1260 days, they apparently fill the role that Moses and Aaron did during the first Exodus. And that what's incorrect about that statement is it says for an additional 1260 days. It shouldn't say for an additional 1260 days. It should actually say for 42 months or time, times, and half a time. And I'll explain that in just a moment. So anyway, go back to verse 6 again. All right, before I talk about the number of days, I need to explain the word they. You see there's a footnote there. It says that so that they may be nourishing her there. Now, it's odd because the word they, or this the term that's in the Greek, is prophosen. And prophosen implies, hang on one second. Okay, prophosen is a third person verb, and it points back to someone. It has to point back to someone because it's in the active voice, which means someone else, third person, must be performing the action of the verb. All right? It's not in the passive voice. That, in other words, it's not that she may be fed there without implying who it was that's feeding her. All right? Instead, it uses the active voice, which means it's talking about someone doing it, and the one doing it is they, that is because it's a third person verb. So literally, it's as I have it here, so that they may be nourishing her there 1,260 days. Well, what's difficult about this passage is that the identity of who they is referring to. Now, it's plural, so it has to be referring to more than one person. Now, the clue to understanding who the they is here that's nourishing her, because, you know, if you look back in the previous verses, there's really no one to identify the word they with. You know, the word, in the pronoun in English, they would require an antecedent. That is something, someone or some persons that were previously mentioned being the ones who are going to be nourishing her, that is the woman, while she's in the wilderness. So the big question is, who is they? Now, it's not stated in this chapter. However, the clue to understanding who they refers to is the statement, 1,260 days. All right. Now, before we go back and look at what that means, look at the sentence again with the bracketed words. Remember, I told you need to put brackets around the clause so that they may be nourishing her there. And then end bracket. Okay? If you put brackets there and then read the verse with that being a parenthetical statement. All right? You know what that means. All right. So let me read verse 6 again. And the woman escaped into the wilderness wherever she has a place there, having been prepared previously from God so that they may be nourishing her there 1,260 days. Now, the reason I have that in brackets is because 1,260 days refers to a specific period of time that's already been mentioned in Revelation. All right? Now, you probably know, if you studied Revelation much, you probably are aware that Revelation talks about certain time periods. And it uses three different expressions to talk about specific periods of time. It uses the term 1260 days twice, and it uses the term 42 months twice, and it uses the term time, times, and half a time once. All right, now you need to write this down because it's really important. Whenever you see the expression 1,260 days, it refers to the first half of this seven-year period, or what we refer to as Daniel's 70th week, that seven-year period that's talked about in Daniel chapter 9. All right. 1,260 days does not equal 42 months. All right. A lot of people think that, and I used to think, that these terms, 1,260 days, 42 months, and the time times and half a time, are just interchangeable terms, but they're not interchangeable terms. They are referring to either the first half of the 70th week of Daniel or the latter half of the 70th week of Daniel. So let me tell you exactly how this terminology is used, and then I'll show you that that's the case, okay? The 1,260 days always refers to the first half of that period of time. The 42 months and the time times and half a time always refers to the second half, that is the reign of the beast. All right? All right, you got that? Now, let's look at those passages so that I can show you that that's the case. All right, now, go to chapter 11 and verse 3 of Revelation. This is the only other time that mentions the 1,260 days. Chapter 11 and verse... Actually, this passage mentions both the 42 months and the 1260 days, but they're not the same. All right, look at this. Look at what it says in chapter 11, verse. Let's read verse. Well, I'll start with verse 1. He says, "And the reed like a measuring rod was given to me, and I was told, quote, arise and measure the temple of God, the altar, and those worshiping in it, and exclude the court outside the temple. You should not measure it because it has been given to the Gentiles." And then you can see that this is in brackets. It says, "They will also trample the holy city 42 months." Now, that statement in brackets is referring to the time when the beast reigns. That is the second half of the week. Now, how do I know that? Well, okay, first of all, if you remember back in Luke chapter 21, when Jesus prophesied the destruction of the temple and the destruction of Jerusalem, which took place in AD 70, he said that when that happened, when they saw Jerusalem surrounded by armies, and then when the city was going to be destroyed, he talked about how that Israel was going to be scattered among the nations, and Jerusalem would be desolate until the time of the Gentiles is fulfilled. And he said in that statement that they, the Gentiles, would trample the holy city underfoot until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. But yet when we get to chapter 11 of Revelation, we see that the temple is being rebuilt and that there are people worshiping in the temple and there are people worshiping at the altar. So the desolation that's spoken of in Luke 21 that started all the way back in AD 70, that is the second exile of Israel from the land, which is marked by the desolation of the temple. That second exile started in AD 70, and it will be over at the time that the two witnesses begin to prophesy. And it will be over because they are worshiping at the temple when the two witnesses begin to prophesy. All right? And they are the ones who are instigating the temple worship and so forth of God there. All right, but then he says in verse 2, he says, "They will also," note the word also, "they will also trample the holy city 42 months." So what we have here is two periods of time where the holy city is trampled underfoot by the Gentiles. The first is from AD 70 until the beginning of the 70th week, and Jesus made that very clear, all right? Because Jerusalem had to be, and the temple had to be desolate during that entire period of time, according to Jesus. Now the temple is rebuilt again. They're worshiping in the temple. But then it says they will also trample the holy city. That is in addition to what Jesus talked about in Luke chapter 21. They're going to trample the holy city again another time. But this time it's only going to be for 42 months. All right? They're not trampling the city of Jerusalem, and the temple is not desolate for the first half of Daniel's 70th week. All right, that's a critical important point. So what that means essentially then is that the 42 months that's mentioned in verse 2 has to be the end or the latter half of the tribulation during when the beast reigns. But then in the next verse it says, and I will give to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy 1,260 days clothed in mohair. Now, the 1,260 days is the time of their prophesying prior to Jerusalem being trampled underfoot for the 42 months. So you can see that the 1,260 days is at the beginning, which is approximately 3.5 years, and then the 42 months, which is approximately 3.5 years, occurs after the 1,260 days. All right, you got that? Now, also, in the book of Daniel, when it talks about the period of time, it's in the 12th chapter, it talks about the period of time between when the beast defiles the temple and it is desolate again, that it will be for time, times, and half a time. And that is equal to the 42 months, okay? So again, that time, times, half a time is talking about the latter half of the tribulation. Now you can see that if you go to Revelation chapter 13, which we haven't really covered yet, but he talks about the beast and the mark of the beast and all that stuff. But it says in verse 5, it says, and a mouth was given to it, and that's quoting from Daniel 7 and 8. A mouth was given to it, speaking great things and blasphemies. And it was given authority to act for 42 months. So again, we see the 42 months refers to the second half of that seven-year period of tribulation. All right. Now, this is important because in chapter 12, because we have that clear distinction, the 1260 days is the first half during which the two witnesses prophesy. The 42 months is the second half during which the beast reigns. All right. Both of those periods are described in Revelation chapter 12. And so by understanding that, it's actually going to identify for us who the word they refers to in chapter 12 and verse 6. All right, and it's a little cryptic, but this is the clue. This is the main clue. All right, there has to be an antecedent for they, the ones nourishing her. All right, so go back to Revelation 12, verse 6. And the woman escaped into the wilderness, wherever she has a place there, having been prepared, that is, having previously been prepared from God, so that they may be nourishing her. That phrase, so that they may be nourishing her, is simply an explanation of why this place was previously prepared from God. All right? So, a parenthetical statement, you can take that, because is simply an explanation. If you take that parenthetical statement out, the sentence should still make sense. All right? So, it says, if I take it out, this is what it says. And the woman escaped into the wilderness, wherever she has a place there, having been prepared from God 1,260 days. Now, when you read it that way, the 1,260 days does not refer to her being nourished there. That is, it's not defining, it's not modifying the verb nourishing. Instead, it's modifying the verb having been prepared, the perfect tense verb, having been prepared. All right, so it's being prepared for 1,260 days. Now, again, because 1,260 days is only used one other time in Revelation, and that was back in chapter 11, as the duration of the two witnesses' testimony, what that tells us then is that this place to which the woman is going to flee is being prepared during the time that the witnesses are prophesying. That is during the 1,260 days. All right, this is a very important key to understanding the timing and the chronology of what's happening in the book of Revelation. All right, so it's being prepared 1,260 days. Now, that tells us who the they is in the previous in that parenthetical clause. Who is the they? The they is the two witnesses. Now, someone will say, well, wait a minute. The two witnesses are killed at the middle of the 70th week. And then their bodies lie in the street for 3.5 days, and then they're caught up into heaven. So they must be in heaven. No, they're not. Go back to Revelation chapter 11 again. All right. In Revelation 11, let me read, let's read the first few verses. And a reed like a measuring rod was given to me, and I was told, arise and measure the temple of God, the altar, and those worshiping in it, and exclude the court outside the temple. You should not measure it because it was given to the Gentiles. In brackets, they will also trample the holy city 42 months. That is the Gentiles. Verse 3. And I will give to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy 1,260 days, clothed in mohair. Now skip down to verse 7. When they should finish their witness, the beast ascending out of the deep. Now, ascending out of the deep is ascending out of the sea, which we see at the beginning of Revelation chapter 13. He says he saw the beast ascending out of the sea. That was the Mediterranean Sea. All right. So he says, when they should finish their witness, the beast ascending out of the deep will do battle with them and will conquer them and will kill them. Well, see, it is when the beast ascending out of the deep, when that occurs, that the two witnesses are killed. So that means that's when he comes to power, according to Revelation 13. So that means that the entire 1260 days that the two witnesses prophesy has to be before the beast comes to power. Okay. Anyway, it says he will kill them, will conquer them. Verse 8, and their corpses will lie in the street of the great city, which is spiritually called Sodom in Egypt, where also their master was crucified. Now skip down to verse 11. And after 3.5 days, the breath of life from God entered them, and they stood on their feet, and great fear fell on those watching them. And they heard a loud voice from the sky saying to them, come up here. And they ascended into the sky in a cloud, and their enemies watched them. Now, a lot of people read that. I mean, the word sky and the word heaven, it's the same word in Greek. All right, so they ascended. You could say, well, they ascended into heaven. A lot of people assume that means they went up to where God is. No, it simply means they ascended into the sky. That is, all of this is being portrayed as viewed from earth. So you can't see somebody ascend. And it's talking about what they saw. You can't see them. People on earth aren't going to be able to see two witnesses ascend into heaven where God is. They simply saw them ascend into the sky. Now, you know, John 3:13 says that no man has ascended into heaven except the one who came down from heaven. That is the Son of Man who is in heaven. Right? And there's no one has ever ascended into heaven. Christ is the only one, the only human anyway, who has ascended into heaven. And he's the one who first came down from heaven. But there are other people in the Bible that it says they ascended into heaven, but it simply means the sky. For example, Enoch, in Genesis, Enoch was said, it says that Enoch walked with God and was not because God took him. And then Hebrews interprets that as God, you know, relocated him so that he would not see death. And a lot of people say, well, Enoch's still alive and he's in heaven someplace. No, it's the word sky. All right. Enoch was simply taken up out of sight and people didn't know where he went. All right. And we see the same thing with Elijah the prophet. Elijah the prophet was taken up into heaven in a fiery chariot, but it was simply means the sky. Now, the fact that they sent search parties out to look for him shows that they did not, those in the immediate area there, those the other prophets actually, did not believe that he was taken up into heaven where God is. They couldn't even imagine such a thing. They just know that he was caught up in the sky and was taken somewhere else. Well, We see in the New Testament, the book of Acts, that the Spirit of God caught away Philip, right? He was in Samaria, I believe it was, if I remember correctly. And then all of a sudden, God just whisked him away. And there he was. Now he's in the desert in the Sinai, and he comes across the Ethiopian eunuch riding along in his chariot. And so he listens to him, and he comes up in the chariot and he explains the gospel, and they stop and he baptizes them. And then all of a sudden the Spirit of God, it says, caught away Philip again. So the idea that a person can be caught up by the breath of God and physically relocated is not that unusual in the scripture. In fact, even with Jesus himself, after his resurrection, if you remember in Luke 24, where he was, the two disciples are walking along on the, on the road to Emmaus, and Jesus suddenly joins them. You know, where did he come from? And after that, they stop and they're eating, and he breaks bread, and they recognize him, and then it says he vanished from their sight. And a while later, you've got the 12 in the behind closed doors, and it says that Jesus appeared. He just appeared at the door. And then it says, after he talked to them for a moment, it says that he vanished from their sight. Well, that doesn't mean that Jesus is some sort of a ghost and he can pass through walls. What that means is that the breath of God, the power of God, is able to instantly relocate somebody. And he did it with Enoch, he did it with Elijah, he did it with Philip, and he did it with Jesus, and he's going to do it again with the two witnesses. So when it says that two witnesses are caught up into the sky and their enemies saw them, it simply means that the Spirit or the breath of God caught them up, just like Elijah was caught up. We know Elijah was not caught up into heaven itself, because 14 years later, according to, I think it's 2 Kings, 14 years later, a letter from Elijah the prophet wrote a letter to the king and condemned the king based on the current events, the current situations that was going on at the time, not what had happened 14 years earlier. So you can't say that, you know, Elijah's letter was written 14 years earlier before he was caught up and then somebody found it and then brought it to the king. No, because it was addressing what the king was doing at that very time. All right. So what that means is either there's airmail delivery from heaven, a letter from Elijah to the king, or else it means that Elijah was simply relocated to another place where he was kept away from the current situation, the current events. All right, so all of these people, Enoch, Elijah, Philip, Jesus, and now the two witnesses, should be viewed as simply being caught up in the breath of God and being relocated to another place on earth. All right. So that being the case, and we have all this precedent for that kind of a concept, it's no surprise now that it says, go back to Revelation chapter 12. It says, the woman escaped into the wilderness, wherever she has a place there, having been prepared from God, brackets, so that they may be nourishing her, 1,260 days. It was prepared during the time the two witnesses were prophesying, and it was probably prepared because of the testimony of the two witnesses. That is, the two witnesses are going to inform as to where that place is, and that place is going to be prepared while the two witnesses are prophesying, so that at the end of their testimony, when they are caught up and relocated, they're going to be relocated to that very place. And that's when the woman will flee to the wilderness. Now, this fleeing to the wilderness is at the midpoint of the time of tribulation, or that 70th week of Daniel. It's the time when the so-called abomination of desolation occurs, when the Antichrist defiles the temple and sets up his image in the temple and so forth. All right? All right, now let's go to verse 7. It says, and that is at this time, that is at the time of the abomination of desolation. It's actually, this is beginning of verse 7 is what leads to the abomination of desolation. Okay, that is, it happens as a result of verse 7. And there was war in the sky. Michael and his messengers fought the dragon. And the dragon fought with his messengers. And they, that is the dragon and his messengers, did not prevail. Nor was any more room found for them in the sky. And the great dragon was thrown down, the original snake called the devil and Satan, the one deceiving the whole world. He was cast down to the ground, and his messengers were cast down with him. And I heard a great... Okay, let's stop there at the end of verse 9 for just a moment. Now, this idea, what John is doing here is he's telling us when Satan is thrown out of heaven. That is, out of the sky. See, the Apostle Paul refers to Satan as the prince of the power of the air, that is, of the atmosphere, okay? That is, from the sky. The sky, in Genesis, when, you know, God created everything, and it says he called the water seas, he called the dry land earth, and he called the expanse, where the birds fly, heaven. So heaven is literally from the surface of the ground, this is the visible heaven, from the surface of the ground to the end of the atmosphere. It's where the clouds and the birds fly, okay? And that is the heavens. All right, so let's see, where was I? Okay, there was no more room for them in the sky. Hang on a second. Okay. That is, there was no more room for Satan and his demons, or his messengers, or angels, to fly around the atmosphere. All right. Instead, they're thrown down to the ground. Now, what does that mean if they're thrown down to the ground? It means they're confined to the land. They're confined to the land. They can no longer travel by air. And what would that mean if they're confined to the ground? Well, what's happening here is that they are taking over possession of humans, bodies of humans. Satan himself will possess the Antichrist. Satan's demons are going to possess a lot of people. All right, so instead of dealing with principalities and powers in the heavenly realms, as Paul says in Ephesians, we're going to be dealing with these same principalities and powers who are now embodied in flesh. And the fact that demons can move into a person is clearly established throughout the gospel, because Jesus cast out many demons out of individual people. I mean, can you imagine? You can see how bad it is now with all the evil and wickedness and corruption now. Can you imagine when all of Satan's demons are inhabiting people and causing them to do these wicked, wicked things? Wow, it's going to get really bad. Well, the devil himself is going to take over the man who will become Antichrist. Then, anyway, it's also in Isaiah chapter 14. A lot of people confuse that passage. It talks about, you know, how it talks about Lucifer being thrown down from heaven, and it uses past tense language in a prophecy. But because it's a prophecy, it's if you read it carefully, if you read that chapter carefully, you'll see that it's from the perspective of his being overthrown, from the perspective of him being cast down. And it talks about all the kings of the earth in their graves, and they're saying, "You have become like one of us, you know, in our graves, buried in our graves." And of course, it's using metaphorical language, just like it does with, you know, Abel's blood crying up from the ground. But it's these kings talk. It talks about these kings being in their graves with all their wealth buried with them, you know, like the pharaohs were and all that kind of stuff. And they're talking to the Antichrist, who's been killed and thrown down in death. And they're saying, you know, "Now you've become like one of us. Is this the man that made the whole world to tremble?" Well, it's, see, a lot of people, when they read that passage in Isaiah, it says, you know, it talks about Lucifer being thrown down out of heaven. They think it's talking about something that happened before creation, you know, somewhere way, way back in the back before creation. They think angels were created before the 6 days of creation, which is completely false according to the Bible. But that Satan fell, and then later after the creation, then this fallen angel Satan comes along and begins to deceive Eve. Not so. It's clear from the scripture that Satan, when he was in the garden prior to deceiving Eve, that he was in Eden. This is in Ezekiel. And he was beautiful and all these different things. And then it says sin was found in him in the Garden of Eden. That's when sin was discovered in him. Well, what was his sin? His sin was deceiving Eve. So Isaiah 14, when it's talking about him being thrown down, is talking about this very same thing that we're talking about here. It hasn't happened yet. Isaiah is speaking prophetically about what's going to happen in the midpoint of that 70th week of Daniel. That's when Satan is going to fall from the sky, or be thrown from the sky by Michael and his angels. And we also see that in Luke chapter 10, verse 18, Jesus says, I saw Satan fall as lightning from heaven. And again, Jesus is speaking in prophetic vision. He's speaking about what Michael and his angels are going to do at that midpoint of the 70th week. All right, he's not talking about a past event, and Isaiah is not talking about a past event. All right, now that we got that straight, all right, let me continue. He says, verse 10, and I heard a great voice in the sky saying, quote, finally, salvation and power and the kingdom of the one, and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ has come, because the accuser of our brothers, the one accusing them before our God day and night, has been thrown down. Now, you may look at the word our brothers as, you know, this is the noise or the voice that he hears, this sound, is coming from the sky. All right? And, you know, you can interpret that one of two ways. You could interpret that as being the angels speaking and referring to humans as our brothers. Well, it's not referring to a equality or brothers in the sense of we are the same being, same kind of beings, that is, angels and humans are our brothers. That's obviously not true in the sense of our essence or our nature. But the Bible uses the term brothers not just for those who are physically related, but for those who are related in their devotion to God. Right, and so Jews and Gentiles become brothers because of their common devotion to Christ and his commands. Right, so the word brothers does not necessarily mean the same kind or the same essence. All right, anyway, he says, this is the voice he hears, and this is what it says: finally, salvation and power in the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ has come. Because the accuser of our brothers, the one accusing them before, notice it doesn't say accusing us, okay? Accusing them before our God day and night has been thrown down. And they were victorious over him through the blood of the Lamb. Now, this is still the voice speaking. It's not John's commentary. A lot of people, when they read this, they think that the quote of the voice from heaven ends at the end of verse 10, but it doesn't. It's still quoting. So the voice in the sky continues by saying, and they, that is, these believers, were victorious, past tense, over him, that is, over Satan, through the blood of the Lamb and through the word of their witness, and they did not love their lives until death. Through this rejoice, sky, and those dwelling in them, alas, to the inhabitants of the land and the sea, because the devil has come down to you having great anger, having known that he has a brief time, and that brief time is 42 months, or a time times and half a time. Now, these people, our brothers here, is a reference to the same group of people that we read about at the sixth seal. The fifth seal. You remember that, actually, let me just flip back there for just a moment. In Revelation chapter 6, it talked about those under the altar, that is the martyrs, right? Or those who had been persecuted in their life previously, from Abel all the way down In verse 9, it says, "And when he had opened the fifth seal, I saw beneath the altar the souls of those slain for the word of God and the witness they were having. And they called out with a loud voice, saying," and this is just like Abel's blood crying up, "How much longer, Master, holy and true, before you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell in the land?" And a white robe was granted for each of them. That's the marriage clothing, garments. "And they were told that they will rest," that is sleep in death, "a little longer until their fellow servants and their brothers, those about to be killed like them, may be completed." And so we talked about that. You may remember I talked about really two classes of martyrs. You've got all the martyrs from Abel all the way up into the midpoint of the tribulation. And then you've got this final group that are going to be killed by the beast. And it mentions them, their brethren, the ones about to be killed back there at the fifth seal. And here in verses, chapter 12, verses 10 through 12, it refers to those same people from Abel all the way down to the midpoint of the tribulation. And it's talking, this voice is speaking about those in the past, that is prior to the time when Satan is cast out of the heavens. All right? Now, verse 13. "And when the dragon saw that he was thrown down to the ground, he pursued the woman who gave birth to the male child." Now, he's pursuing the woman. Now, again, who is the woman? The woman is the representation of God's children of promise. All right? Sarah and her descendants. It's not her physical descendants, per se, as Paul says in Galatians 3 and then in 4. It is those who have been baptized into Jesus Christ to altogether make up the woman, okay, in this allegory. All right, so the woman is fleeing to the wilderness. Verse 13, "And when the dragon saw that he was thrown down to the ground, he pursued the woman who gave birth to the male child. And two wings of a great eagle were given to the woman so that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished there for a time, times, and half a time." Again, that is equal to the 42 months that was mentioned back in chapter 11, and it's the other time that this is, the time, times, half a time, is in Daniel chapter 12, and that period is from the abomination of desolation until Christ returns. All right, so she's nourished for the latter half of the time of tribulation. She is nourished there from before the snake. "And the snake projected a current of water from his mouth after the woman that he might sweep her away with the current." Now, frequently there are in the Bible a flood or a current of water, a flood especially, is equated to a horde of soldiers, an army, that is an overwhelming army that is attacking something. And so that's what we see here, is that the beast sends forth, Satan does through the beast, sends forth this enormous army to persecute and to destroy the woman while she's fleeing into the wilderness. That is, believers who are fleeing into this place of safety that's yet to be identified by the two witnesses when they get here. All right, but what happens? It says that the land rescued the woman, verse 16. "And the land opened its mouth and swallowed up the current the dragon projected from its mouth." And there's precedent for this. We have after the Exodus, we have some of the children of Israel were defiant against God and against Moses, and it says that the earth opened its mouth and devoured them. That is, them, their families, and their tents and everything fell down into this chasm as the earth opened up, and then it just closed in over the top of them. Well, that's what's going to happen to this army that is pursuing the believers while they're fleeing to this place of safety. Verse 17. "And the dragon," because of this, his armies are being destroyed, "the dragon was enraged against the woman and departed to battle with the remnants," notice that plural, "the remnants of her seed," that is, the little bits of believers who did not flee. the remnants of her seed, of those who are keeping the commandments of God. So it identifies the woman here as collectively those who are keeping the commandments of God and holding the testimony of Jesus. And so not all believers are going to flee to the place of safety. There are going to be other believers that do not flee to the place of safety who are going to be persecuted by the beast, who are going to stand in his face and accuse him. You know, Jesus talked about, even to his disciples when he sent them out, he said that you're going to be brought before kings and rulers as a testimony against them. So God has got some of his people that he's going to use to stand, to be, they're going to be persecuted, they're going to be attacked, they're going to be brought up on charges to be executed, but in that process, he's using them to pass judgment upon their accusers, God's judgment upon their accusers, and that's what that last verse is referring to. All right, okay, well, that's it for chapter 12. Next time, we'll get into chapter 13, which talks about the beast arising out of the sea, that is the beginning of the Antichrist's kingdom. All right, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I'll see you again next time.